AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. It's expected to take weeks to pick jurors and alternates for the first criminal trial of a former U.S. president. None picked today in the Donald Trump porn star hush money case. After Iran's larger-than-expected attack on Israel, the White House is making it clear what comes next and how Israel responds is ultimately up to them. ABC's Mary Bruce in Washington.
While the president is underscoring America's ironclad defense of Israel, the White House has also made clear and said the U.S. will not participate in any retaliatory counterstrikes against Iran.
House Speaker Mike Johnson has proposed four separate bills be brought to the House floor on aid for Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and a fourth this week, trying to get around opposition of Republican hardliners to helping Ukraine. Another body is recovered from the Baltimore Highway Bridge crash site. The Supreme Court allowing Idaho to enforce its ban on gender-affirming care for transgender youth while lawsuits proceed. This is ABC News.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. A statue honoring the first black woman elected to statewide office in Wisconsin is going up in front of the state capitol building in Madison this summer. The project got final approval Friday. Vell Phillips was elected Wisconsin's Secretary of State in 1978. The O.J. Simpson murder trial 30 years ago had a lasting impact on the way Americans consume news. Commentators became a fixture of trial coverage, and they're still used to interpret current events to this day.
It also meant that people could suspend their critical thinking to a certain extent. And I believe we're still seeing that today. The rise of social media has only made it easier.
Jane Kirtley teaches media studies at the University of Minnesota. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
An unsuspecting driver at a Milwaukee barbershop.
I got an apprentice here shadowing me. I'll put this hot towel on, man. About a good 3 minutes, all right?
The apprentice is Donald Driver.
So when you come here, you drive?
Yes.
Your car got seatbelts?
Yeah.
You wear them?
No.
Okay, but why not?
Because I don't want to.
But do you know you can get a ticket for that?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give you a ticket. Bet you wish you buckle up now.
Oh, my God.
Donald Driver can't always be there to remind you.
Take it, click it. There we go.
Click it or ticket.
And let's reduce fatalities on Wisconsin roadways. Sponsored by Wisconsin DOT.
This is Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Happy Billionaire Appreciation Day. Yeah, we've done it. Congratulations. We've got billionaires. And thank you for your sacrifice. You know, as greed-driven inflation has hit working families, as child poverty has doubled thanks to our Republican friends who oppose the child tax credit extension, as homelessness is nearing record highs, rents and housing are through the roof, and making ends meet is just getting a lot harder, we can celebrate Billionaire Appreciation Day. After all, like I said, we created them. Thank you, America, for creating billionaires. We're number one. We're number one. You know, and we did it. We did it with massive tax breaks, loopholes, bailouts. Oh, my. According to the folks over at Americans for Tax Fairness, they got a report out that points out that you are 806 billionaires. They are now collectively worth $5.8 billion, meaning that they control one out of every 25 bucks of American wealth. They own over 50% more wealth than the entire bottom half of the U.S. society, roughly about 65 million households. But hey, there's more to be done, and you can again thank the people responsible, the good folks in the Republican Party.
Civic Media.
From Ronald Reagan to George H.W. Bush to Donald Trump in his 2017 tax hatchet job. Because look, these are the people, these are the tax fetish. We got to cut taxes at every, that is the tool in their box. Now, understand, our economic elite, they have seen their wealth explode in really what is an exceptional amount of time. In fact, so fast that there's just no way that they earned it. There's just no way they were out there selling enough widgets and whatnots. They weren't certainly not putting enough burgers together. They certainly didn't have enough hours in the day to punch the clock and work hard, pull themselves up. No, no. Lots of help from our Congress that they seem to spend a lot of money on. Understand, in 2017, and again, thank you, Donald Trump, for the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act from the president who had a net loss of jobs during his term. But thanks to that one piece of legislation, the one piece of legislation they actually got done, the billionaires saw their wealth double. And what, you know, what kind of a payoff is that? You know, it made me think of my grandfather, because you see billionaires spending an awful lot of money on politics. And look, if it's the argument that I make about paying my union dues, I pay, two and a half times my hourly wage in union dues per month. And all the benefits that I get. And when I was doing organizing, I would say, hey, I pay like $50 a month, and this is what I get. I get health care, and I get a pension, and I get a good wage, and I get job security because I'm not an at-will employee. All this great stuff. And the return on investment is fabulous. The billionaires got me beat. They give a couple of $1,000 to a congressman to ensure that they pass the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and their wealth, boom, doubles. Doubles. In 2017, think about this for a second. In 2017, there were exactly zero people with over $100 billion. Zero. There were none. Thanks to Donald Trump, thanks to the pandemic, thanks to, well, our tax system. We now got 10. We've got 10 billionaires. The top 10, well, actually the top 10. Our top 10 are all billionaires or centi-billionaires, meaning 100. Jeff Bezos topped that list as of April 1st with $198 billion. Wallace, Mike Bloomberg at the bottom, the poorest of the all-star billionaire brigade with just $106 billion. I think I'd take his place if I could. And look, we should all celebrate. And what should we do with this celebration of our billionaires? What should we do in our to pay homage to our billionaire class? Well, Trump and the GOP, they've got a plan. You guessed it. More tax cuts. Of course we should make the rich richer. Of course we should give them more because they know what to do with it. They're smart. And I don't disagree with this. They do know what to do with it. They make themselves more money. And that thing we were told that it would trickle down, something would fall down on us, rivers of gold and honey, manna from heaven. No, not so much. But hey, understand. We've got the most billionaires of any country in the world. That should be a sign of our national pride. We're number one in billionaires. Take that, you commie socialist countries. You and your universal health care. You and your paid vacations and holidays. You and your generous paid family leave for both parents most of the time. So when a child's born, they get to stay home and, bond with the child. You and your commie social safety nets to make sure that, when people hit hard times, they don't go completely bankrupt. You and your shorter work weeks, your higher minimum wages, your stronger labor rights, your investment in education. Oh, you commie socialists, we got billionaires. I got nothing more than that. I mean, the reality is we have made the choice as a country, evidently. Evidently, and this is what elections are. Elections are the referendum on the choices that we make in our politics. So are we surprised when billionaires get everything that they want? Are we surprised that we have policies that pandered to the wealth class? No, of course not. Because we don't seem to be all that interested in actually solving problems. It's more about the problems than it is the solutions. So am I surprised that we don't have, you know, universal health care so that when someone gets sick, they don't go bankrupt? When they get sick, they don't have to worry about, hey, am I going to lose my job? Am I eventually going to lose my care, my home, my family? Yeah, other people don't think about that. But then again, they don't have as many billionaires. We're very fortunate. We've got billionaires. And of course I'd want to give up, you know, any bit of a safety net of, you know, higher unemployment. So when you lose a job that you don't end up going broke or taking the first crummy job you can get just to put food on the table. No, no. Thank goodness we don't have that. Because we've got billionaires. And, you know, thank goodness, you know, we don't have education plans and training programs so that people can follow that as far as their talents and their skill can take them. No, we want to make sure that they got deep enough pockets. And you may sound, but go, Rick, I'm feeling some sarcasm here. And you should. Because it's incredible to me that on Billionaire Tax Appreciation Day, we all pay our taxes and a lot of them. Understand, I do believe, and I agreed with the Tea Party, working people in this country are taxed enough already. I agree, 100%. You know who not? You know who's not taxed enough? Yeah, you got it. Our billionaire class. Because according to the Federal Reserve, our tippy-top, the 1% folk, who own, what, 23.3% of all of the country's wealth, which is an increase from last year with what that was 22.8%. So again, getting wealthier, taking more of the pie, even as the pie grows, they're still getting more and more. According to the most recent IRS data, though, that individual taxpayer's rate, just around 26%. Now, that's the 1%. That's a lot of people. Once you get up into that rarefied air of the, you know, the 1% of the 1%, that number goes, wow, down. Way down. And understand, we've done this. We've created a political system that ensures that they get what they need. Because we have a tax code that is insane. And this is where the right gets me. I'm with you, man. We got a bad tax code. How do we fix it? No, we're just going to complain about it. Because it's easy to complain about, because if you actually start going, you know, it's screwed up that, as Warren Buffett said, his secretary pays a higher tax rate than he pays. You would go, hey, that's screwed up. Because virtually everybody I've ever met believes in progressive taxation. They believe that the people with the most ability to pay taxes should be the ones who do it. Again, my analogy of, you know, the biggest guy carrying more water back to the cave. You don't have the 30-pound child bringing water back because you're not going to get much. You get the 250-pound muscular guy who could carry, you know, buckets and buckets. That's who does it. But that's not how our system works. Because, again, we've got a political system that keeps throwing out some red meat to us, making sure that we fight over nonsense instead of fighting for things that are going to make lives better. So what have we done? Well, we've given the wealthy and powerful the ability to avoid taxes. Now, this isn't tax evasion, and I was saying this all during the Trump years. I want to see his tax returns, not because I think he did anything illegal, but because I want to see what legal he did that his class benefits that the rest of us don't. And then present it. Go, look, is this the best we can do? You know, business owners get to claim a whole bunch of stuff. And for small businesses, you go, well, that's helpful. But I don't know, should you be able to deduct a yacht? Yeah, you can. Should you be able to, claim all kinds of things like hire your children on your payroll without actually have them doing real work? It's not like they're competing in the marketplace. There's a lot of these loopholes that we've given or they've lobbied for that they take advantage of. And this is where I've said on Billionaire Tax Appreciation Day, maybe we start looking at some of that. Now, interestingly enough, I do find it interesting in this Billionaire Appreciation Day, the same day that the Trump hush money trial starts. That's kind of interesting to me that the hush money trial begins on April 15th. Huh. And I got to wonder, again, back to my idea of I think we should see his tax returns, because I want to know, did he deduct the hush money? And, oh, the Truth Social investors, since you can write off, you know, your gambling losses on Wall Street, you know, how many of their losses at Truth Social will they be writing off? And the thing is we're giving them all this stuff and we're not investing in us. Quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you may remember back in 2021 when President Biden signed the bipartisan infrastructure law into effect. One of the things that was in there was the creation of something called the Public Transportation Agency Safety Plans Regulation. This was the idea, I guess, and I hope, protect our transit workers. Well, on Tuesday, April 9th, they published the first major update to this Public Transportation Agency Safety Plan Regulation. And here to share some thoughts on what this means and if it's going to keep workers safe. I've asked John Costa to come talk with us. John is the international president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, ATU, ATU.com, the website. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. And nice to see you again.
Good to see you as well. This is kind of a big deal. Steal a Bidenism. It's kind of a big freaking deal, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's a long time coming. It's a big deal. It's something that we've been pushing for and struggling to hope that the regs came out in favor of workers in our industry that have been being abused for way too long.
So what is this? What was the original regulation? What is this and what's it going to do?
Well, it puts some guidelines in on, you know, what the committees are going to look like. They're going to be safety committees with the equal number on both sides, labor and management. We will actually not have a voice anymore, but actually have some rights to put in guidelines and plans on the blind spots that are out there that is hurting our operators and the pedestrians on the street. Do we have bad blind spots, especially on the left-hand turns? We've proven that, you know, to put barriers in to stop our members or protect them better than they're being protected now for, you know, all types of assaults that are being done on them every day, from punching, spit, throwing stuff at them, if not slicing, you know, and stabbing them. So we'll have say on the barriers and also on, you know, with COVID coming out, we understood that, you know, the barriers now and the air filter system in the buses, we understood and found out that they were not safe. They were actually harming us. So now we'll have a say on what type of filters are being used and how the air regulates in there. So we'll have some guidelines that these three things need to be spoke about, and we need to have a plan on how they're going to act, where they just can't say, yeah, we heard you, but we'll think about it and get back to you.
Yeah, I got to tell you, John, this is something that I've been, we've been dealing with you guys for, you know, over a decade now.
And this has been constant throughout the entire time, keeping drivers safe from passengers who sometimes get unruly, protecting that blind spot, as you pointed out, and also making sure that the drivers are secure in their place. It's amazing to me that it's taken this long to get to this point, to get what seemed to be just common sense solutions. It just seems amazing to me that we're still here.
Yeah, it is crazy. The more we point things out, I just don't get it. I just don't understand how you're not listening to the worker that we've proven what these blind spots have done and what it has. If we would have acted earlier on this, how many lives we could save and how many operators' jobs and stress and mental stress that they went through after these accidents of wondering, like, I never saw this pedestrian.
Yeah, but John, I mean, isn't there the sane reality? Shouldn't even if you had to make the corporate self-interest argument, if you're hitting things, cars, people, whatever, you're going to have to pay for that. It's going to cost you an enormous amount of money. So just mitigating those risks before they happen, a much cheaper thing than having to go through all of that, and on top of it, having workers who are going to be stressed and having problems and all of that. It just seems dumb that this hasn't already been fixed. And then on the other side, thank goodness for the Biden administration for moving in a direction to address it.
Yes. Finally, we had an administration that understood us, understood the workers, the transit industry, the FDA, many meetings with them. A lot of work from our staff proving the problems that in the work area, you know, the workstation of a bus and the design of the bus, that we need to redesign a bus. We need to actually, you know, it's time that we take a look at this and redesign it. Hopefully this is the start of getting there.
Yeah, now look, the thing I like about President Biden, here's a guy who knows a little something about public transit. Here's a guy who rode the train for years. So I would have to think, you know, if sitting where you're sitting, having him in the White House is someone who is a friendly ear.
Yeah, he's someone that took a train every day back and forth to work. And also, when he was younger, he actually drove a school bus for, you know, as a job. So he knows a little bit of the industry. He knows what we go through. And he listened and he spoke with us, and the administration came through. So it's a start. I mean, at least we have finally the regs came out, and the regs, we're happy to see that it's a start that we can build on.
So as you've said, this is going to give you equal voice in committees to at least point out and move towards solution. Whereas before, what was the environment before this regulation?
Before, we had safety committees, but the safety committee, sometimes you wonder, it was just something that the company was doing to fulfill an obligation or to get some funding, I always said. I sat on back in my career at the North City Subway. I'm out of a light rail division. I've sat in these safety committees, and many times it wasn't really addressing the problem. You know, some agencies are better than others with the safety committees. Trying to identify hot spots, dangerous areas, you know, areas where we're having a lot of assaults, where operators are afraid of going through, and maintenance area where we need better equipment, where the equipment is old, moving into, the maintenance area where EVs are coming in now, electric, you know, the tools need to be different. So these committees, this would all be talked about. Sometimes we get, we'll have some solutions and be able to agree on some, but many a times we did not. So now this will put us in a position where, we'll have more say, and hopefully the agencies have to adapt. This is a change because they're not used to, you know, it's always a fight. I don't know why it's always a fight to have labor at the table. They know the job best. I always said that you should have us at the table. We can help you. We can help you identify problems and give us a better, you know, product.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, even if it's just in your radical self-interest of, hey, we want to make more money, we want more profit, we want more productivity, asking the workers how to get there, probably not a bad idea. Because if they're happy and they feel they have some say and they're protected, they're probably going to be, well, more productive and more profitable. It just seems like common sense. But I saw this statistic from the Federal Transit Authority. According to them, over the past decade, assaults on buses, both physical and verbal assaults, have jumped like 400%. And yet, you know, we're at a point now where we're talking about it a little bit more, but still haven't really done anything yet. Or am I missing something?
Yeah, it's crazy. Since the pandemic, 400% it's up. And part of that problem is our union fighting and getting those numbers. You know, many a times they're not reporting on assaults. They may only, report the ones that people had to go, the operators or, our members had to go to the hospital for. But many of them, they were sweeping under the rug, hiding. It was just a national newscast that I spoke on in California, where they weren't reporting on any of these incidents, not only happening with our operators, but also with the riding public. So it's just crazy, and I think that the push that we're explaining this, and every time an operator is assaulted, and we get a copy of that video showing how alarming this is. I mean, you're having buses hijacked with machetes. This is all over the news, and we're sending that to the administration. We're sending that to the FDA. Here, look, here's another one. Every day, here's another one. Here's another one. So I think, the videos are visual, and, you see it. You can't deny it, right?
Yeah.
You're looking at it. This is terrible. So, yeah, it's the increase is crazy, and if we don't do something about it, nobody's going to get on the buses, all right? The riding public's not going to get on the buses.
No, and that's an excellent point. But is this new? I mean, is this something that since the pandemic, or is this something that because everyone's got a video camera in their pocket now, we're documenting more of the horrible things that are happening? I mean, when I was a kid, things always happened on the bus. I just don't remember it being at the frequency that we're seeing.
I say it all the time. An operator's job is not what it was 30 years ago. I don't know if the society is just different. If the cameras that we have, the phones we have, more is video, we see more than we ever did before. I rode buses in my day. I born and raised in Newark. I used to go to school taking a bus. I went to work on a bus. It isn't like today. I mean, today is just it's crazy out there. I mean, New York City, they had to bring a National Guard in, to try to get some safety out there. Let's see how this works. And actually, I think it's going to have to happen in other areas. Chicago's main, we have a lot of problems there too with our rail system.
Yeah, and this is where, as someone who advocates for public transit on all levels, bus, rail, all that, because I think it's the most efficient way of getting people to and from places. I think you do have to come crack down on making places safer so that you bring more people to it, in addition to more funding to make it more user-friendly and better opportunities to use it. But if you can't get the safety part right, it's not going to matter. I don't think it's going to matter how much more you throw at it to get more people on. They're going to probably want to stay away.
No, Rick, I don't understand. Like they took away bodies and security, and they thought cameras were going to solve the problem. It didn't solve the problem. We just see the problem much more. We're seeing it. And so cutting bodies and talking about, automation and having, could you imagine not having somebody on a bus? You think people are going to feel safe just because you have cameras? We need security out there. We need more bodies out there that, somebody can feel if there's a problem, they have somebody that's there to help them.
Yeah, last question I've got for you, because you brought up more people on the train. And last week we did talk with our friends over at the Smart Union about the administration coming out with a minimum of 2 people on all trains, be that freight, rail, or passenger. Any thoughts on the new reg for a minimum of two people on a train?
Yeah, I come from light rail. I worked in Newark at 4 o'clock in the morning in Penn Station by myself. Sweeping, cleaning up the lanes there and the bus shelters, and I would go in and I'd be nervous, I'm there by myself, And I made my complaints to the so-called safety committees they had back then, and they got me nothing. You know what the solution was? They gave me finally a handheld radio that I can communicate after I was assaulted and hopefully I wasn't bleeding to death. No, so I made those arguments that they were, oh, we should be two people, we should at least be two people there to help each other, watch out for each other. And if an incident happens, at least there's somebody there that can help, that person survive, whoever it was that was assaulted.
Well, this is a good thing. It's a step in the right direction. I'm glad for your members. I hope they take advantage of this and we move towards ensuring that they're safe at work, that you deal with those blind spots and we move forward so that, people can get back and forth where they need safely, efficiently, and cost effectively. But John, I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick, and I appreciate you asking me to come on and talk about this.
Anytime. I appreciate it. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. You want to check out John Costa and the Amalgamated Transit Union, ATU.org, the website. We'll get links out on social media. Quick break. Right back.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Mostly cloudy skies to take us through the overnight, and by sunrise, temperatures near that 40-degree mark. We'll have a light east breeze. On Tuesday, we'll see partly sunny skies, highs near the 60-degree mark, still breezy, and some rain chances developing in the late day. Right now, it's 51.
Busted Pencils with Dr. Tim and Dr. Johnny.
I wonder what Matt Damon's mom would say when it comes to teaching science to little kids.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask her.
And there she is, Dr. Nancy Carlson Page. Welcome to Busted Pencils. Nancy, how are you?
Hey, I'm great. It's great to see you. It's great to be here.
Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Weeknights at 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I gotta tell you, glad to hear that something being done on the transit front, and our good friends at the ATU are gonna have a mechanism by which to protect their workers. I gotta tell you, this is something we've been talking about on this show for well over a decade. Same thing when you talk about the two people on a train. That just seems like common sense. But again, there are things that are being done. There are things that are moving towards solving problems, towards solutions that we don't get to hear about. There are things getting done. The problem is it's just not cutting through the noise. And for me, as I've said, a gazillion times on this show, I'm someone who wants to get things done. My true north is, how do we make things better for working people? How do we solve problems instead of the problems being what define us? Understand, and I get this from people across the globe, the rest of the world's looking for what post-global America looks like. They're looking for the next global leader because they don't think it's us. They see dysfunction here at home because, again, we don't solve problems. We create them. And we've got a lot of finger pointers who want to do nothing but continue to cause problems. Look at this transit issue, for instance. This, in a functional society, doesn't get to happen. What, you can't see if there are cars next to the bus and a mirror might help? Why don't we have a mirror there? Why isn't there, we've got the technology, why isn't there a sensor there? Oh yeah, profit over people. What, you've got transit workers who are getting beat up because you've got people on the buses and on the trains who are angry? How do they get to the bus driver? Oh, there's no partition, there's no way for the bus driver to protect themselves while they're out who knows where at all hours of the night? No one thought of this? Now look, I've been wondering since I was a little kid, why is the bus driver just sitting there? Why is that box of that, I guess you could somehow get to the money, just driving around with one guy? Because again, it's not about solving problems. It's about profit over people. And we see this over and over and over again. And it's not surprising to me. The other thing I say is, you know, given enough repetition, you can get people to believe just about anything. And what they've done to us, they've trained us to be hyper individuals. It's me. It's all about me. It's all about the me. I am not getting what I want. Instead of thinking on a societal level of, you know, when we all do better kind of thinking. When we have a higher minimum wage, you know, wages go up for everybody. Corporate America understands that, which is why they fight so vehemently against minimum wage increases. They don't care about the person at the bottom. They don't care about that person making $7.25 going up to $10 an hour. What they care about is that ratcheting up all above the system. Because what does that mean? Well, means less profit for them. And they get that. They understand it completely. So what do? Well, they've got to blame that poor minimum wage worker. Well, you're going to drive inflation. How dare you ask for enough money to put a roof over your head and food on your table? And it's worked. Understand, they have trained a working class to believe that the benevolent dictator is their boss. Because I said the other day, and I got some positive response from people going, you know, Rick, you might be right. The American working class, I don't know that all of them agree that democracy is a good thing. Because you're right, they do work in undemocratic environments. Unlike union workers who have some bit of democracy in the workplace, the vast majority of workers in this country do not. They work in dictatorships. The boss, dictator or benevolent dictator, but authoritarian leader. You do what I say, when I say, how I say, I'm going to pay you what I'm going to pay you, and when I say I'm going to pay you. And if I don't, well, maybe, you know, sue me. So it got, I'm in this mindset that, you know, there's a lot of work to do. So recently I was at a labor event. And I was talking to somebody who I've known for years. We've spent time working together throughout the years. And I thought, you know, and I think we have a good relationship. I'm not sure where things are at this moment. But this is a guy who's out there fighting the good fight. This is somebody I respect. Someone who's out there, you know, working hour after hour after hour. I would argue some hours, some weeks, he doesn't even make minimum wage for the number of hours he puts in fighting for the members of his union. And he represents a lot of public sector workers. And you know, as we were having this conversation, he was lamenting on how difficult it's been since the Janus decision, since Trump Supreme Court justices made the choice on Janus to make the entire public sector of this country a no rights at work environment. So that the wonders of right to work are working in the private sector as they're meant to do. Tearing people apart, defunding unions' ability to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, and then causing the kind of internal strife that this guy was lamenting about. That people go, well, I get all the benefits for free? Why would I pay? Again, back to why they did it in the first place. But it's one of these moments where, you know, I had this question. And I asked, I said, you know, what happens if Trump is endorsed by unions, or what happens if Trump wins in 2024? And his response surprised me, because it wasn't about Trump. It was about Biden. It was your basic F Biden. I'm never voting for that blankety blank blank Biden, never. And I was like, wow, I didn't expect that from you. Well, why? Walk me through, you know, explain, you know, help me understand what it is that I'm missing. Because maybe you're somebody I respect. You're somebody who I've had, you know, conversations with over the years. What's your thinking? Well, immediately the temperature rises. And I'm someone who can have a conversation with people that I don't agree with. I'm someone who I want to know. I actually have to know. It's kind of one of those weird things where I want to know what you're thinking. And because maybe my thinking is wrong. Maybe I'm missing something. Now, understand, this guy had just given me, you know, a dissertation on how hard it is to organize private sector workers because of Janus, and voting against a guy who is the most pro-union president of our lifetime, who has done a bunch of stuff to move organizing in the right direction by appointing Jennifer Abruzzo as general counsel of the NLRB, our Secretary of Labor. You know, all of the mechanisms are moving into, you know, making life a little bit easier for working people who want to demand better wages, hours, and conditions. So I'm figuring, you know, that's an argument back. Evidently not. And it wasn't so much that love of Trump. It was the hatred of Biden. And it comes back to this kind of repetition that is in our corporate-controlled media. You keep throwing out the same thing. You know, the first club out of the bag was, it's all about the transgenders. And look, there's a lot of stuff on the transgender front that I don't get, any of it. There's a lot of things that I'm probably never going to understand. And that's okay. You know, I've had friends who have transitioned, and I've always told them the same thing. I don't understand it. Thank goodness I don't. And I wish you the best. I want you to have the best life you can have. I wish the best for you. Hope this is what makes you happy. Because, you know, as a kid, I grew up believing in that idea of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness for everyone. But fixated on the problem, fixated on the fact that the belief that these people had more rights, and asked the question right straight out, you know, should they have more rights than me? And my answer was no, of course not. But nor should you have more rights than them. That's our system. Our system is, we have rights. Within the confines of our four walls, we got them all. Or I'd like to believe, other than if you ask a Republican, talking about women's reproductive rights. So we walk down this path of now his tone and his rhetoric is sharp and angry. And I'm just going, well, one, how'd we get here? And two, well, how do we fix this? What would you see as a solution? Because you're talking about voting for a guy who wants to do some pretty draconian things, especially to the organization that you work for, especially to the people that you fight for. And I couldn't help but as this conversation is going on, that this idea of selfishness and jealousy just keeps, you know, being thrown, all of the worst things of humanity coming out of this conversation. Now, look, I like this guy. I respect him and have for years. And I think he does a good job at what he does. But when you start to hear some of the things that come out, I struggle. And he's not alone. Understand, this isn't just one guy. I've had, you know, hundreds of these conversations. The reason that this one was different is, you know, it ended on a real sour note. It ended, you know, like some of this does, you know, where I don't know if we'll talk again. I don't know where this goes. And it's sad and it's unfortunate. Because these conversations have to be had. While this person simply wanted to be angry and justify this hatred of Biden for perceived slights against him, for supporting someone else's rights, we come back to this place where we're not solving any problems. We're not getting anything done. We're not fixing anything. And I'm struggling with that. I'm struggling with that a lot because I'm sure a lot of us have these conversations that end relationships. And that's horrible. You know, I remember early on in the Trump years where people said, oh, I'm never talking to that Trump supporter. I'm going, why? How are you going to understand them if you don't talk to them? How are you going to maybe move them back to sanity at some point when things don't work the way that they're told? Because again, remember, all of the things that Republicans have told us that they were going to fix, they haven't. The rhetoric that we hear, for instance, someone brought up to me that, you know, the crime rate's out of control. Cities are riddled with crime. The homicide rates are through the roof. Yet, just today, in fact, I read an article from the Wall Street Journal not some hippie liberal publication, but the freaking Wall Street Journal, the newspaper of the investor class, where they wrote homicides in American cities are falling at the fastest pace in decades, bringing them close to levels that they were before the pandemic. Nationwide, they write, homicides dropped around 20% in 133 cities from the beginning of the year through the end of March compared with the same period of 2023. So, headline, homicides are plummeting. Still believing because it's what we're hearing. It's what the talk radio mouthpieces are throwing out. It's what the cable news people are throwing out. It's what's being reinforced. Cities are hellscapes, violent, crime everywhere. Social media doesn't help because, hey, if it bleeds, it leads. And here I am talking about democracy, talking about, hey, how do we save America? How do we save the democratic process? How do we ensure that we leave something for our children worth inheriting? You see, George Sununu, not George Sununu, Chris Sununu, Governor Sununu from New Hampshire, on with George Stephanopoulos, talking about why he supports Trump now. And Stephanopoulos is like, hey, just so I get this clear, you're going to support Trump regardless of what happens if he's convicted on the classified documents case. You're going to support him, you know, because even the fact that he contributed to the insurrection, you're going to support him even if you believe that he's lying about the results of the last election. You're going to support him blindly even if he's convicted in the Manhattan case, even if he's convicted. And he goes, look, I just want the answer. Is the answer yes? And Sununu says, yeah, me and 51% of Americans. And look, I don't think it's 51%. I think it's like 30, 35. But that's a large percentage of people in this country who facts don't matter. Reality, democracy sure as shine doesn't matter. But it's about now fighting for their guy. Because their guy is under attack. So when Trump was asked about all of the things, he's like, well, you know, I'm fighting for you so you don't have to. No, you're fighting because you did things that were wrong and you should be held accountable. And we're not that country anymore. We don't solve problems and we sure as heck aren't accountable for our actions. And the selfishness and the jealousy and the hooray for me and the heck with everyone else, it's kind of frightening. So the question I couldn't help but come away with this from this conversation with is, how do we rebuild relationships where you can have honest discussions that are geared towards solving problems and not just making more? Or am I just, well, overly optimistic that we can save America? Because I got to tell you, the America that I grew up loving, the America that I grew up believing in, is not where we are today. It's sadly that simple. The fact that you've got Republicans in Congress spreading Russian propaganda on the House floor frightens me. The fact that a political party in this country is doing everything they can do to, well, destroy this economy. And you go, well, that's the Democrats. No. Biden has done virtually everything he can do to bring this economy around. In fact, doing so well that economists are predicting, yeah, that recession thing we kept saying was going to happen, yeah, probably not going to happen. Because again, the narrative is more important than the reality. The story that they tell us is more important than actually making lives better. Because if you had to actually sit down and fight over policies that were going to make lives better, that would be hard work. If we were really talking about some of the things I said earlier about, you know, paid family leave, about national health care, about universal education for everyone to go as far as their talents can take them, you know, all of the things, you know, actually having some life-work balance, with shorter work weeks, maybe more vacation. Heaven forbid we crafted policies that made lives better. We've devolved into what is the worst of us and are pushing that as policy. Question is, how do we change that? What direction can we go to fix it? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'll tell you, at this moment, I'm a bit taken aback. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1916. That was the day that the American Federation of Teachers was founded at a meeting at the City Club in downtown Chicago. Three Chicago teachers groups helped to organize the meeting. They were convinced that in order to improve working conditions for teachers, they would need to formally join the labor movement. In 1902, the Chicago Teachers Federation had become the first teachers organization in the nation to join their Central Labor Council. Now they believed it was time to form a national organization. The meeting was also attended by representatives from nearby Gary, Indiana, as well as New York City, Washington, D.C., and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Just a few weeks after the meeting, the American Federation of Teachers had received its charter from the American Federation of Labor. The new union grew quickly. Within 4 months, 174 locals approached membership of 10,000 educators. But then came a backlash from school boards who did not want to negotiate with the new unions. Board members publicly called into question whether it was appropriate for teachers to unionize. The American Federation of Teachers numbers fell to below 5,000. But the union was not swayed from their cause. They renewed their efforts and again began to grow. In the 1950s, some teachers became the targets of anti-communist hysteria. This highlighted the importance of having a union to protect academic freedom. The 1960s was a time of increased teacher actions and strikes. The American Federation of Teachers more than tripled its membership from 60,000 to 200,000 by the end of the decade. Today, the American Federation of Teachers represents more than 1 million members across the nation. While under increasing attacks, teachers are an important force in today's national labor movement.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Now, I don't want to leave the impression that I'm only talking about right-wingers who do this stuff. Because, look, the reality is, in this country, what we've done is we've gotten into our silos and we play this game of I'm, you know, me, mine, my rights, without understanding that everyone has rights that should be respected and that we should be a little more tolerant of each other on all sides of the equation. So if there's this thought that... Yeah, because during the break, my mind goes to, you know, look, there's not a lot that I agree with that goes on the left either. And sometimes they get a pass from me because it's overwhelming on the other side. But sometimes the left does kooky, stupid stuff, too. I point to what's going on, what happened out in Bakersfield, California. Evidently, there is a clip of a woman crying in court. Because she was charged with 16 felonies because she threatened murder the city council members unless they voted to endorse a ceasefire in Gaza. And it's one of those things where, look, you can be in favor of the ceasefire, you can be against it, whatever. Whatever your position, I'm not getting in the middle of all this. But understand, Hamas isn't looking at going, oh, well, gee, Bakersfield, California. Well, that's a target demographic. This idea that we're fighting over stuff that does not, and we're doing the dumbest stuff. I got to tell you, threatening the city council members that you're going to kill them if they don't do this thing that they really have no power is well, in 20 years, you know, this person's going to regret it. But on each side, one side's holding her up as a hero. The other side, she's a villain. When the reality is, the sad reality here is, this one was not the right way to go about exercising your right to protest and making your thoughts and opinions known. But it ramps up the violent rhetoric that the right would really love to see. And we're just in this moment where you go, can we talk about getting something done? Because this is counterproductive. If you really want a ceasefire, is this the arena that you fight in? The answer is no. Now, I look at Florida. And again, you know, while we're fighting over things that we can't change, Republicans are fighting for things that will harm us. And as it was pointed out, that with just a stroke of the pen, the governor of Florida said that, you know, local governments, sorry, you can't protect your workers from outdoor work. No protection for outdoor workers. That ended the Miami-Dade efforts to have legislation to keep workers safe in the heat. So farm workers, construction workers working in extreme heat, you're now less safe in Florida thanks to the governor. And understand, this is purely ideological. It makes no sense other than the other side did it. And if the other side did it, clearly we have to be against it. And what I love is that the story goes into, even before the bill was drafted last November, there were lobbyists in place ready to fight against it from, you know, the real estate and the agriculture industries who watered the bill down and you know, just killed the idea of having some bit of heat restriction in place that would help working people. And this is just, I mean, it's a small thing. You go, wow, you know, Texas did the same thing. These preemption laws that we see in states across this country are designed to thwart democracy, especially when you're talking about working class democracy, especially when you talk about workers trying to make their lives better. And I think this is really important because I hear people on the left, I hear the Democrats saying, well, this election's about democracy. No, I think this election's about the heart of America. I think this election is about who are we as Americans, and as the rest of the world pays attention and looks on, what are we telling the rest of the world? Are we a partner in the rest of the world, or are we going to be, well, what we were during the Trump years? The reality is we saw what Trump 2.0 will look like. Only it'll be worse. So on January 20th of 2017, when I said, look, folks, it's going to be a rough 4 years. There's going to be a lot of criming. There's going to be a lot of chaos. There's going to be a lot of dysfunction. There's going to be a lot of not getting done, especially for working people. It's going to be bad. I could not have imagined that it was that it could have been any worse than it was. And in the next 4 years, if Trump is elected in 2024 and becomes president on January 20th of 2025, I will say again, look, it's going to be bad. And it's going to be even worse than I can even possibly imagine. Because they've already told us, they've already said, this is where we're going. We're going to cut taxes for the rich. We're going to make billionaire day every day instead of just on April 15th. We're going to fire all of those government workers and replace them with good old-fashioned patronage hires, loyalists. Not to the American people, not to democracy, not to clean water or air or safe environment or any of that stuff. No, no. Loyal to dear Donald. Loyal to dear leader. Loyal to bad ideology. And I got to tell you, it's a bit frustrating, folks. So the question I have for you, which side? Which side are we on? Are we on the side of authoritarian individual, hooray for me and the heck with you? Or are we on the side of community and democracy? I think this election's about much more than just democracy. I think it's about America and about the future of our country and this world. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast or visit freespeech.org to find the videos. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to...
This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.